Good people. So far, what we have done is that we have, just to summarize what we have done so far, this is a very elaborate subject. So I'm not going to kind of summarize everything in great detail, what we have done. I think we have done enough revisions, but we will summarize in essence. And yesterday's topic probably will go a little more in detail. The first day we started with understanding the difference between the human and animal species, and we found that rather than focusing on the common things, we have to focus on what the potentials of a human being are, which is the ability for higher inquiry, making the right choices, and having the experience of a greater amount of bliss and pleasure. But having said that, for us to experience happiness in this world, we need to understand how to overcome real problems. We saw that to overcome real problems, we have to find a solution. It cannot be a temporary solution because temporary solutions do not last long. Therefore, the permanent solution is connection back to God. And then the next day we discovered of the different processes by which we can understand that God exists. We saw 4 or 5 proofs for the existence of God. And we concluded that session by saying that for us to understand God properly, we need to have faith in the scriptures. Because scriptures are the books by which give us the connection to God. And when we have faith in the scriptures, then we can understand the subject matter properly. Now, what does the scripture talk about ourselves that we discovered on day 3? We saw that the scriptures talk about all of us not being the body, but being spirit souls or the Atma. And the concept of being the Atma is a concept of finding an identity which never changes. An identity that is an eternal identity, and that is an identity which is constant even after death. So then we also saw the different proofs for the existence of the soul through science, near-death experiences, past life memories, and so on and so forth. And then we concluded by saying that if we can learn how to see the soul through a process, then we will have more faith. And more than that, we also learned that the soul or the Atma is an eternal part of God, who is the super soul. And then the next day, that is yesterday, we saw about this concept of one God or many gods. We initially only concluded that there is only one God, ultimately, only that the same God has different names. And then we went into a discussion of why we have so many scriptures when there is only one God, why we have so many religions when there is only one God. So the understanding that we came up with is that the scriptures talk about why there are so many scriptures. Give the example of a mathematical student. Just like we have elementary mathematics, higher mathematics, and advanced mathematics. So similarly, the scriptures are according to the level of the audience. If an audience is having a lower level, so the scripture is given according to his understanding. We saw examples of Jesus Christ's life, of how he was teaching to people who had a certain caliber. And whatever he taught also was, you know, almost, he was persecuted for that. We saw the life of Prophet Muhammad also. He was dealing with a certain level of people. And therefore, he had to use language, you know, which was practically unthinkable of in human society. And then we saw how at the same time, Krishna is speaking to Arjun. And Arjun's capacity and caliber, we saw that Arjun is a person who had such a pure and such a untouched character, a spotless character. And then Krishna is speaking to Arjun. Therefore, when Krishna concludes, he says that whatever knowledge he has given is the ultimate knowledge. He doesn't need any other knowledge to know. So that is what the Bhagavad Gita is. And then finally, we also saw about this concept of one God or many gods. We saw that there is only one God. And even that God, does he have a form or no? We saw that God, three things we concluded in that. One is that, first of all, God has a spiritual form. And the second thing is that he doesn't have any material form. So any form of God which we see, it cannot be a material form made up of matter. It is different and it is spiritual. And then we concluded also that God has a formless aspect to it, which is his energy. And what is that formless aspect? I will be showing you all today with a diagram. And then we concluded that based on the scriptures, based on the understanding of, of course, we saw also that four levels of scriptures, you know, four levels of religions, on the level of fear, on the level of reward, on the level of duty, and finally on the level of love. And then we saw that Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita are scriptures which talk on nothing than the level of love. That is a platform on which they talk. And then we started discussing about what do the scriptures say about who is that one God. Then the understanding we came up with is that the scriptures say that one God is Krishna. And then we put Krishna on a judgment scale where we try to judge him whether he actually satisfies the two definitions of God. The definition that he's a supreme source, supreme proprietor, supreme enjoyer and supreme controller. And then I spoke about how Krishna speaks in the Gita about how he is the controller or he is the source of all matter. I spoke about Bhumi Aponalo Vayur, Kammano Buddhi Evacha, Ahankaramiti Manme, Bhinna Prakriti Karshada, where Krishna is saying that he is the master or is the source of all the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether. Ether, some people have doubt about what ether means, kham. Ether is a very subtle understanding of it's actually in English language, if you want to translate it, it's vacuum. Vacuum means that is a space where there is not even air. So within our body also, there are certain spaces which have not even air in them. They are, you know, airtight spaces. You know, there's no movement of air. So such a thing is called vacuum. So Krishna is the master of even vacuum. And of course, the subtle elements, mind, intelligence and false ego also, he says. And the next verse, he claims to be the source of everything spiritual. So he has claimed himself to be the source of matter and also the source of spirit. And then he also speaks in the 10th chapter, 10.8, Aham Sarvasa Prabho Mata Sarvam Pravartate. He says, I am the source of everything spiritual and material. So then we also saw that it is not just that, he's speaking, but he also shows in his life. We saw when he was a few years old, he was showed the whole universe within his mouth. And we also saw how when Arjun wanted to see the Virat Roop, he showed the whole universal manifestation. And that also explains why and how he could cover the sun when he was fighting with, when Arjun was fighting with Jayadrath. So, of course, Krishna at every instance, he shows how he's actually the master of everything. And the resources run according to his needs. If there is a certain law which is functioning, the law is functioning because he desires it. That is why we can see when Lord Ram was building the bridge, the stones were floating on water. It was against the law of nature, but he is the one who made the law. So naturally, like a police, they make a law that you cannot break a signal. But when the police is trying to catch a criminal, he doesn't need to follow his own law because he is the one who made the law that you should not break a signal. But because the police understands the higher purpose behind the law. The higher purpose behind the law is to maintain decorum, to maintain sanity in the society. Therefore, sometimes to achieve a higher purpose, the lower purpose can be broken. And that is how we understand this. And then also we concluded that Krishna also fits in the definition of the second definition of God, which is Bhagavan, the one who is possessor of six opulences in completeness. We saw how Krishna is Lakshmipati. We saw how Krishna is the lifter of the Govardhan hill, the strongest of the strong. We saw how Krishna is Madana Mohan. That means he is the one who can enchant Kamadev, the personification of love. And we also saw how Krishna is also the most knowledgeable person. The knowledge of the Gita speaks a lot. And including that, he is also Vyasadeva is a literary incarnation of Lord Krishna. So the wisdom that has come out from Vyasadeva, this one personality, is unlimited. So that shows the knowledge capacity of Lord. And we also saw how Krishna is also the most famous. I was speaking about fame, not just from this world, from the planet Earth, but from the universal experience. And we will know, we will understand what the universe is when we discuss more in detail today. And then finally we saw how, in spite of having all these five opulences in completeness, Krishna is perfectly renounced. We saw the example of how Krishna was ready to serve as a chariot driver of Arjun in a very humble spirit. And we also saw how Krishna was ready to serve all the saints and people by washing their feet. So different exhibitions of humility of Lord Krishna. This shows the character of renunciation. That's how we concluded that Krishna is that one God. And then we spoke about what about the others. Then we said all the others are demigods. And then we spoke about four categories or four tattvas, which was the essence of what we discussed yesterday. The first tattva is called the Vishnu tattva, which are Lord Krishna and all his incarnations. And then we gave the example of an actor playing different roles. He's the same person. Then second, we spoke about Shakti tattva, which is the energy of the Lord. So some of the energies are inferior energies, some of the energies are superior energies. But both are his personal energies. Third, we spoke about the Shambhu tattva, which is Lord Shiva. Very special category. He is neither God, but nor is he a common living entity. We gave the example of milk and yogurt. And then we also finally, fourth category we saw was the Jiva tattva, which includes the demigods, the human beings, the animals, the plants, everything else. The Jiva tattva. And then we also saw that chart, the flow chart of how from Krishna, all these different Vishnus come out. And finally from Paramatma or the Shiradaksha Vishnu comes these demigods and the material universes. And then we also concluded by studying the difference between worship of Krishna and the worship of the demigods. We saw that though if you want to actually worship somebody, if you have to worship the demigods, we have to worship 33 crore demigods, which would take about 3,819 demigods per second to worship, which is really too much, impossible. And then we also saw that even if you want to worship so many of them, each one has his own ways of worshiping and own ways of, you know, approaching, which is not really practical and not possible also. And we also run the risk of displeasing someone, you know, one of them, in trying to please the other. And then we saw the practical solution is that if you water the root of the tree, the whole tree gets nourished. Similarly, Lord Krishna, he claims in the Gita, Aham Adirhi Devanam. I am the source of all the devatas. I am the source of everything in the world. So therefore, the practical solution is that if you can worship the root or water the root, then everything else gets nourished and satisfied. That is the essence of what we concluded yesterday. But today, we will begin the discussion on coming back to our life. Coming back to seeing the world from a situation which we can, you know, observe and see all around. And we will try to address this topic. Why do bad things happen to good people? Now, I would like to tell you all, I am going to give you all concepts. But the detailed application of these concepts is very, very case sensitive, right? And therefore, to understand how to apply this subject, what we are discussing, requires a lot of guidance and also a lot of practical understanding. You know, unless you understand the subject matter deeply, you will not be able to understand how to apply it in your life. And there are chances that we may make the wrong conclusions, right? So having said that, and also having said that this is a massive session, I'm going to begin. Why do bad things happen to good people? This is a question which is probably one question that has always haunted human society and has always been a source of food for the atheists and antagonistic people, and has been a source of doubt to people who are theists and worshippers of God, and has been a source of a lot of discomfort for people who are good. And it actually challenges the quality of being good itself. And therefore, we need to understand this better, and we need to understand it from a practical approach. One time, one elderly lady approached a saint. Some people say it was Lord Buddha. I don't know the exact reference to it, but whoever it is, this elderly lady approached this saintly person, and she was crying like anything. She said, "You have to help me. I'm in the greatest misery of my life." And this elderly person, he said, "What do you want? How can I help you?" So this lady, she said that my young son, he died some time back. I cannot tolerate it. He said, "How can this happen?" And she told him that, "Please revive him. Please get him back to life. I know that you can do it. Please get him back to life." So the saintly person said, and he tried to convince her, you know, using logic. He tried to convince her you know, giving a proper explanation. She was just not being able, being convinced. And then he decided to help her in a very different way. He told her something very interesting. He told her, "I will revive your son." So immediately she started smiling and she was like, you know, she had expectations and hope. And then he told her that, "I will revive your son on one condition." He said, "If you can get rice from the house where no death has happened, I will revive your son." So she immediately ran. She started running from house to house, you know, asking them for rice. And then when people were giving the rice, she said, "You give me rice if there's no death that has happened in your house." "No, no, no," they said, "this uncle of mine has died. You know, somebody said my mother has died. Somebody said this person has died." So then she went from house to house, house to house, house to house. Then after going through the whole village, she came back with a lot of realizations. With the realization that when we see that there is suffering in our lives, we should also know there is suffering in everybody's life. It is only that it's a question of relativeness. And it's a question of how you perceive your personal suffering. So then she came back and she told him, "I'm sorry, I've got the answer to my question." And she went back. So we have to first understand that everybody suffers. But more than that, trying to understand why some people suffer in a different way is something that we are trying to explore. So we find in today's world, you know, in society, that some people are, without studying very hard, they get really good marks. And some people studying extremely hard, they end up failing or practically just scraping through. We find that people are, you know, getting into so much depression and anxiety because of something they want but they're not able to achieve. And you always find that relationships are going for a toss because people are not able to understand why something is happening in a person's life. And because of the misunderstanding of why things happen in other people's life, it becomes like a difference of expectation. The mother has an expectation from the son has an expectation from the parents, the wife has an expectation from the husband has an expectation from the wife. But things really don't go the way we plan and the way we desire. So now I want to tell you the story of the life of Charles Darwin. This will explain to you why he came up with this theory called the theory of evolution. This is something that hardly people know. When somebody does something, generally why he does what he does is always inspired by something that has happened in the past in his life. Unfortunately, nobody goes into the past, but people try to understand situations, understand, you know, different things that are happening from the present. Many times it can be very deluding and sometimes it can go on a wrong track. So Charles Darwin, he was a very orthodox and a very strong Christian, practicing his spiritual life very seriously. But at some point of time in his life, there happened something which he was not able to digest, which led him to parallel thinking. So at one point of time when he was going to the church, three things happened which completely shook his understanding of life, you know, to a great extent. The first thing that happened was he was seeing that he's going to a church, he's going to a spiritual place, he's going to a place where God is worshipped. But he was finding that people are constantly talking about miracles. People are constantly talking about miracles. And they're saying, you know, if you follow Jesus, if you follow this, this miracle will happen. And over here, this miracle happened. And Darwin, very intelligent man, he realized that there's no miracle that is happening in people's lives. They were just talking about it, but I'm not able to see any miracles happening. First thing. Second thing, he said, he realized that the church, the authorities, the priests in the church, though they were supposed to be people who are renounced, people who are supposed to be living a very saintly life, but they were after power. And they were controlling their congregation, you know, but they didn't have the power. And that put him off. He said, why should people control? control resources, control money, control people. Why should you do that? So he got off. And the third thing, something which happened, completely shook up his faith. He had a young son who died of an unknown cause. And when his son died, Charles Darwin was not able to, you know, reconcile. And these three things, you know, took him on a journey. And his journey was very simple. He said, I am out to study the world and to prove that there is no creator and no controller. And the concept of having no creator was a concept of how things evolved from chemical evolution. And the concept of having no controller is a concept of theory of evolution. That means the species, you know, evolve themselves without any control. Right? So he studied about, you know, he traveled for a few months, and whatever he saw and observed, the different species, became the box for this whole theory. And so when we see the reason why he started it, we understand the background. And because that was in his mind, that is what I want to prove. This is called atheism, which means that God is neither the creator nor the controller. I'm going to share with you all, as we go ahead, different concepts. The first concept is called atheism, where God is neither the controller nor the creator. And then there is another concept called deism. I will tell that later. There's another concept called theism. And there's a fourth concept called Confucianism, right? So the first one is atheism, where Darwin realized that. So he set out to prove that there is no creator and no controller. So his whole thesis aids that conclusion and is directed towards that conclusion. And therefore, many things in his thesis cannot be explained logically, because they are made for that conclusion. Just like I was telling about this example of giraffe. Giraffe's neck being extended didn't make sense. Similarly, he gives another example of how the whale was formed. You know, it's almost like a joke, but it's written in his book. He says that one time the bear, it jumped into the water and opened its mouth very loudly, very big. And then eventually, over a period of time, it became a whale. This is something that is almost like a hilarious joke, but it's actually written down, and people were actually accepting it for a long time. Again, the concept of how from ape human beings came. This concept seems to be logical, but the question is, if the ape evolved itself to a human being, why are apes still existing? So, of course, we can go on and on in details discussing. There is one man, one scientist, I can share with you all that video if any of you all are interested. He made a video, 101 reasons why Charles Darwin's theory is stupid. 101 reasons, pointing out from different quotations from Charles Darwin's theory. So if anybody wants more reference, I can give you that video. Anyway, coming back to our discussion, I'll tell you a story. One time, there was a family called the Clark family. They were from Europe. And all their life, for years and years and years, this family worked very, very hard to earn money, to save a lot of money. And their aim in life was to sail on the Titanic, the bond voyage on the Titanic. They saved their whole life saving to be excited about it. And about 1 week before the Titanic was to set sail, the son of the Clark family, he was bitten by a dog. And when he was bitten by a dog, you know, at that time, the treatment was so different. They said, the doctor said, he cannot travel. He has to be quarantined. And they actually didn't allow the whole family to travel. And for that 1 week, they were cursing like anything. They were cursing, what nonsense is this? How can God do this to us? We have all our life saving is going in this. And then exactly after some days, when the Titanic sank, they started thanking God. They said, God is great. Whatever he does for a reason, you know. This is called confusion. You don't know whether God is great, you don't know whether God is not great. Confused. You don't know whether God is a creator, you don't know whether God is a controller. Confused. Right? So, we don't want to be in any of the boats without logic. Right? And then, there's a very interesting story which will introduce us to this topic nicely, of why sometimes God does bad things to us. There was a very wealthy man, and this wealthy man, he was very charitable also, and he loved to give charity to as many people as would come to him. And you know, he was realizing, and he was sharing with his friend, that I am giving so much to people, but no one looks up to me and thanks me for what I am doing. No one. At least people should be grateful to me. So he was sharing this with his friend. So his friend gave him an idea. He said that tomorrow when people come, don't open the front door. Go to your balcony and stand. And he said that when people, you know, come with expectation, throw stones at them and then see what happens. So this man, you know, he didn't want to do it, but he said, let's try. So then he took stones, stood on the balcony, and when so many people gathered, he started throwing stones at them. Everyone in the crowd started looking up at him and started shouting bad words. And then he said, at least now people have looked at me. So many times, God has to do that. Because when everything is fine, everything is perfect, nobody wants to even look at him, nobody wants to recognize his existence, nobody wants to thank him for what he's giving us, for the unlimited he's giving us. So sometimes God has to shake us up, and sometimes he has to throw stones at us. And one stone hits us, that is the time we turn to God and start shouting at him and blaming him for everything wrong that is happening in our life, without being grateful for the unlimited things that he's already done to us. So that brings us to a story of one person. His name is Arthur Ashe. This person was a very famous Wimbledon champion, tennis champion. And every year, one time, you know, I'll tell you this background first before I get into details. This man, he won the Wimbledon championships 7 consecutive times. 7 times consecutively. Created a world history. And when he just got his last medal, after a few days, he was detected to have a deadly disease. And he was going to die in about 6 months. So when his fans came to know about his disease, they started writing letters to him. You know, they were shattered actually. And one man wrote a letter to Arthur Ashe. And he wrote a letter. In that letter he mentioned that of all people in the world, why is God doing this only to you? Why not me? Why not anybody else? And then Arthur Ashe wrote a letter back to this fan. And this is what the subject matter of the letter. He said, every year, about 500 million people begin to learn tennis. About 500,000 people actually learn how to play. And 50,000 people actually learn professional tennis. And out of them, only 5,000 people enter the Grand Slams. And only 50 qualify for the Wimbledons. And out of the 50, only 4 reach the semifinals. 2 reach the finals, and only 1 holds the trophy. And his conclusion was, I was holding that trophy 7 consecutive times. And he said, that time when I was holding the trophy up, I never asked God, why me? And now that I have this disease, what right do I have to ask God, why me? This is called theism. Accepting the fact that God is a creator, and accepting the fact that God is a controller. So, the Bhagavad Gita is divided into 5 topics. This is the essence of the whole Gita. I spoke about this, but these 5 topics are, first one is Ishwar or God. The second one is Jiva or the soul. The third one is Prakriti or material nature. The fourth one is Kala or time factor. And finally, the last one is karma or activities. The last 4 days, We have been spending unlimited time on Ishwara, that is God, and on Jiva, or the soul. But today, we will spend time, the remaining three. Material nature, Kala, and Karma. Because we are trying to cover three big major chunks of the Gita in one day, it is exhaustive, naturally. So we will begin by studying Prakriti. Now, when we try to understand Prakriti or material nature, it brings us to a very interesting section. And this section is fascinating because it talks about something that we can't see. And it talks about realities of life that we have never been taught. Like when we concluded the first day, we concluded by saying that this is the wrong place and we're searching for the right thing in the wrong place. Which immediately brings us to the point that there is a right place somewhere. So that is what we need to explore now. What is the right place and what is the wrong place? That brings us to the introduction of something called the spiritual world. One time there was a man who... There was a princess and she had a beautiful diamond necklace. The necklace costed about 10 crore rupees. And this necklace, she was wearing it and, you know, standing in her balcony. Suddenly a crow came and picked up the necklace and ran away. And this princess was completely shattered. She said, you know, she started crying and she went to the prince and told him that, "I need that necklace, the crow has taken it away." So the prince, he said, "Don't worry, I'll give you another necklace. I'll give you a necklace which is worth 100 crore. She said, "No, I want that one only because you've given me a lot of love and affection." Sometimes people can act like that. So then this prince, he sent out a notice to the whole kingdom that anyone who helps find that necklace will get a handsome reward. So that everybody started looking for the necklace all over the kingdom. And then one man, he came to know about it. And he went to a particular place and he spotted something glittering. So he realized that maybe this is the necklace. And then he saw that the glitter is coming from a pond. So he thought that the necklace is in the pond. He said, "If I can just jump in and pick up the necklace and come off, I'll be the richest man." So he became very excited. So he jumped into the pond and he realized that there is quicksand. So the moment he would step in, he was sinking, and he immediately somehow jumped out. And then he tried, you know, going from different sides, you know, to reach the necklace. And then after some time, he was quite frustrated. One wise man came that side and he asked him, "What are you trying? You know, what are you searching for?" So he said, "I'm trying to find the necklace. And, you know, I can see the necklace is there, but somehow I'm not able to go because there's a quicksand." So the wise man said, "Look up." And he saw the necklace was hanging on the tree. And he only saw the reflection in the water. And he thought that the reflection is the necklace. This man is all of us. We are looking for the diamond of happiness. And we are looking at it in the reflection, the material world. And the spiritual world is a reflection of the material world. You can sit up. You can sit up. There's a chair here, there's so many chairs. So the spiritual world is a reflection of the material world. So what we see here is the Bhagavad Gita gives example of a tree, of a banyan tree, which is inverted. So have we ever seen a banyan tree which is inverted? We have never seen a banyan tree which is inverted. But we have seen it in the reflection in a lake. If a banyan tree is standing on the shore of a lake, so you can see the inverted reflection of the banyan tree inside the lake. So the Gita says, Krishna, this is the profound philosophy of the Gita, which says the material world is an inverted reflection of the spiritual world. So the highest thing in the spiritual world is the lowest thing in the material world, and the lowest thing in the material world is the highest thing in the spiritual world, right? So that's the understanding. Now let us begin to understand, what is the spiritual world and material world about? So the answer to these two questions, where has the soul come from, is the soul has come from the spiritual world, and where it has come to, has come to the material world. Now, if I say it has come from the spiritual world to the material world, I have to quantify what is spiritual world and what is material world. This brings us to a description of the spiritual world and the material world. I'm going to show it to you diagrammatically. This description is in the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam in verses. So what we have done is that we have kind of compiled all the verses in a diagrammatic format so that we can easily understand it. And this is how the spiritual world and the material world look. And I'm going to spend some time trying to understand the spiritual world and the material world in depth. So the spiritual world is the portion above that pink line. If you can see the pink line there. This line over here. This line is the line which separates the spiritual world from the material world. And there is a space between this line to this line. Everything below this line is the material world, and everything above this line is the spiritual world. And in between there is a gap. I'll tell you what that gap is later. So essentially the spiritual world looks like this. So the spiritual world is 3/4 of the creation, and the material world is 1/4 of the creation. Though right now it looks exactly half, you know, they exactly look of the same dimensions and size, but it's not like this. This is just to diagrammatically represent. So the material world is only 1/4 of the entire creation of God. That means we are sitting in not even 1/4 of the creation of God, and we claim that we know everything about creation, right? That means whatever we know about the solar system is confined within one universe. I will explain to you details of what is the meaning of one universe. So that means, that shows us that how limited our understanding of system is. And so the explanation that is given in the scriptures is that if you take the whole sky as the spiritual world, the material world is one cloud in the sky. That means it's actually the most insignificant part of the creation, the most smallest part of the creation, the most neglected part of the creation, right? And unfortunately, because we are there, for us it is everything. So let us try to understand what else exists. So let us first focus on the spiritual world, and then we'll come back to the material world. So the spiritual world is centrally a lotus. A beautiful lotus forms the center of the spiritual world. And the lotus has 1,000 petals. And the middle of the lotus, the whirl of the lotus, is a place which is called as Golok Vrindavan. This is called as Golok Dham. That is the place where Lord Krishna resides with all his eternal associates, the gopas, the gopis, his parents, the cows, unlimited of his associates. That is the middle of the lotus flower. This is called Goloka Vrindavan. And below Goloka Vrindavan, if you see this part, this orange part, this is the place which is called as, so here basically, you know, somewhere within this area is where there are two places. One is called Dwarka Dham and the other is called as Mathura Dham. So Mathura and Dwarka are located just outside the whirl. So the central whirl only has Golok Vrindavan. Just outside the central whirl is Dwarka and Mathura. Now, there is one very interesting feature here. You can see this place. This is called Ayodhya Dham. This is the place where Lord Ram stays with his eternal associates. And then you will find all these unlimited petals. All these petals are different places in the spiritual world. And the spiritual world operates in a very different way than the material world. When Krishna and his associates want to travel from one part of the spiritual world to the other part, these are huge distances. Huge distances. But what happens is that when the Lord wants to travel, the petals come together. So it's not that Krishna has to actually move from one petal to another, but the petals come together. And then he hops over, and then the petals separate again. So this is the spiritual world. And the spiritual world, from this point onwards, it is called as the Madhurya Dham. Madhurya Dham means this is a place where there is sweetness. Below this structure, even in the spiritual world, there are structures. Below this structure, this place is called as the Vaikuntha Dham. There's a difference between Madhurya and Vaikuntha. What is the difference? The difference is that in Madhurya Dham, there is sweetness. And in Vaikuntha Dham, there is awe and reverence. So worship of God within this structure, this place, is with awe and reverence. But worship of God within this structure is with sweetness, with love, with intimacy. So the intimate associates of Lord Krishna, they go and they reside in the innermost part. Here the relationships are very different. So you might find somebody who is a worshipper of God sitting on the head of God, right? Some of the friends of Lord Krishna, they would sit on his head, but they were servants of Krishna. And for the pleasure of Krishna, they would sit on his head. This is something that is mind-boggling many times. Just like the prime minister of a country, he may be very strict, very official, and very charismatic when he's in his office, wearing a suit, wearing a tie, very, very formal. But when he goes home and his grandson is there, grandson will say, "You become my horse." The prime minister has 100 people who can, you know, become the horse of the grandson. But the grandson only wants that horse. So the prime minister of the country, you know, becomes like a horse, and the grandson is sitting on his head and riding. So now, somebody might say, will the prime minister not get offended? Of course not. That is what intimacy is about. So he is a prime minister for the outside world. But for his family, he is one of them. And that's what gives him the greatest satisfaction. 100 people saluting him will not give him as much pleasure as his grandson sitting on his head. Right? So that's Krishna. So the Madhurya Dham is where the Lord associates with his devotees in 5 rasas. Rasa means taste. Rasa means mellow. Rasa means relationship. And what are the 5 rasas? The first rasa is called Shantaras. Shantaras, the devotees who are in Shantaras, they are dealing with the Lord, is very, very neutral. I mean, there is hardly any exchange. Like for example, the trees in Golok Vrindavan, the trees in the Madhurya Dham, they are in Shantaras. They do not talk. They do not, you know, interact with the Lord so much. But they are serving him in Shantaras. And they get an unlimited amount of pleasure. The stones in Madhurya Dham are in Shantaras. When Lord Krishna steps on a stone, the stone melts. And the stone becomes soft so that Krishna's feet doesn't get hurt. So the stone is not having a relationship with the Lord, but the stone is serving the Lord. Similarly, all the living entities who are in Shantaras serve the Lord in a neutral way. Yeah? Yeah, spiritual world, even the appearance of material things are spiritual only. Like Lord Krishna looks like a human being, but his body is Satchidananda Vigraha. In the spiritual world, everything is Satchidananda Vigraha. Everything is having a spiritual body. It may take the appearance of material things, like a stone or a tree or wood, whatever. But they are all spiritual in nature. That is the understanding. And the second rasa, which people, the devotees exchange in the Madhurya Dham, is called as Shantaras, Dasyaras. Dasyaras means the devotees are in the mood of servitude. They want to serve the Lord. Just like Hanumanji is in the mood of Dasyaras. Lakshman is in the mood of Dasyaras. So many of these devotees are in the mood of Dasyaras. Their only aim in life is to become a servant of the Lord. And they don't want any other relationship. If you tell Hanumanji, for a change, can you become the brother of Lord Ram? He's not interested. Right? So they love the relationship of being a servant of the Lord and assisting him in his pastimes, whatever way he wants. So the third rasa is called as Sakya Ras. This is called serving in friendship. That means here the devotees of the Lord are serving him by being friends. And friendship means intimacy. Friendship means, you know, no formality. So therefore, sometimes the friend, while serving Krishna, you know, Krishna would eat from the other person's mouth. Madhu Mangal, one of the friends of Lord Krishna, and he would be drinking buttermilk. Krishna would want the buttermilk from his mouth. Madhu Mangal would not give. So Krishna would bang his mouth and all the, you know, the chas would come out from his mouth. Now if somebody sees that, he will get completely bewildered. One time Lord Brahma saw that and he got completely bewildered, and then one full pastime took place. Brahma was, I'll describe details some other time. But somebody who doesn't understand Sakya Ras, he will get bewildered. But relationship in Sakya Ras is on a very intimate level. Higher than Sakya Ras is called Vatsalya Ras, where the relationship is of a mother and a father. So for the mother, the one who becomes a devotee in that relationship, for that person, Krishna or the Lord is a son. So the mother cannot see the Lord in any other way than as her son. And you know, when Krishna was lifting the Govardhan Hill, while lifting the Govardhan Hill, you know, he is showing his supreme power by lifting the whole hill. But Yashoda, the mother of Krishna, is thinking that how can my son lift this for long? So she was actually, you know, massaging his hands, massaging his body to make him strong, to be able to lift. So why does Krishna need her massage, right? But that's the nature of love in Vatsalya Ras. And higher than Vatsalya Ras is called Madhurya Ras, where there is conjugal dealings between the Lord and his devotees. So you should remember that these dealings are not material dealings, because there is no matter involved. And when there is no matter involved, everything is spiritual, everything is pure. So the relationships are extremely pure in nature. And therefore, the only mood of these devotees is to serve the Lord in the way he wants them to serve him, right? So these are different levels of rasas. But in the Vaikuntha planets, in the Vaikuntha Loka, you do not find these five rasas. But here, everyone exhibits one standard rasa, that is Dasya Ras. That means everybody is in the mood of awe and reverence, right? That is called Vaikuntha. And the meaning of Vaikuntha, what is the meaning of Vaikuntha? Kunta means a place of misery. Vaikuntha means a place where there is no misery. So from this point on, there is no misery. There is no existence of birth, no existence of death, no existence of old age, no existence of disease. No material problems enter into the spiritual world. That is why it is called as Vaikuntha. And there is a place we are trying, aspiring to enter. And if you find something very interesting, here you find one very unique structure. This is the place where these four personalities, Vasudeva, Sankarshan, Pradyumna and Aniruddha, if you remember yesterday we discussed these four personalities, they reside here. And every planet in the Vaikuntha planet is belonging to one incarnation of the Lord. This planet belongs to Lord Varahadev. So that means all the devotees of Varahadev, those who are attracted spontaneously to Varahadev, come to this planet. Those devotees who are attracted to Narsingadev come to another planet. This is Matsya Avatar. Like that, there are unlimited Vaikuntha planets because there are unlimited incarnations. Generally, our understanding is that there are 10 incarnations. But the actual understanding from the Srimad Bhagavatam is that the how many incarnations are there? 24. No. The Bhagavatam says that as many waves are there in the ocean, that many incarnations of the Lord are there. So there's no limit to the number of incarnations. We only have access to 10, 20, 30, like that. If you study the Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll probably have access to about 100 incarnations of the Lord. But that is limited, right? But actually, the number of incarnations of the Lord are unlimited. And each incarnation has one planet. And all the devotees of that particular incarnation of the Lord come and reside in this planet. And those who are devotees of Krishna come and reside in his personal Golok Vrindavan. Those who are devotees of Lord Ram enter there. And those who are devotees of the different incarnations enter here. That is how the spiritual world is structured. Now, let us go and study how the material world is structured. Before that, we'll see the between the two. So, when you come below the spiritual world and above the material world is a space. And there is a mountain over here. This is called Kailash. Mind you, there are multiple Kailashes also. This is the Kailash where the original Lord Shiva stays, who is called as Sadashiv. He is the original Lord Shiva. And he stays in this abode, which is between the spiritual world and the material world. Therefore, I said, he is not completely God, but at the same time, he is not a normal living entity who is staying in the material world. He has a very unique and special place. And if you see this, something written called Brahma Jyoti here, this white space. Now I'm going to take you one step backwards. And you have to spot something very interesting. If you see this, this is light. Okay? And if you trace it backwards, you can see that the light is going behind. And if you actually trace it backwards, the light is coming from the whirl, from the center. It is actually coming from the body of Lord Krishna. This is the effulgence of the body of Lord Krishna. And the effulgence of the body of Lord Krishna is spreading all over the spiritual world, and it reaches to the outer covering of the material world. It doesn't enter into the material world. That light is called as Brahma Jyoti. Now, something very interesting. Yesterday, I told you all that Srila Prabhupada had gone to Africa, and he told the African people that God is black, but he's not black like you. But then, what is the meaning of he's not black like black of this world? I'll tell you now. Does black reflect light or absorb light? Black absorbs light, right? Here is Krishna, who is black in color, who is reflecting light, who is emitting light from his body. And that light is spreading all over the universe. That means Krishna's body color, the black, is not like the black of this world. And the light that is coming from the body of Lord Krishna is called as Brahma Jyoti. And this is something that is attractive. Why? Anything connected to the Lord is attractive. So therefore, people who do not have access to anything beyond the Brahma Jyoti, when they come across the Brahma Jyoti experience, they are completely satisfied. Why? Because it belongs to the Lord only. Right? Just like if somebody comes from a village and first time he's coming into the city and first time he's seeing a train, and you know, when he goes to this railway station, he's excited, I want to know what a train is. And then he finds that at a long distance, suddenly a big light is coming, you know. And this fellow, he says, wow, I've seen a train, and he goes back. The friend tells him, wait a minute, the train is not light, there's something more. So he says, okay, no problem, let me wait. So he waits a little more. The train comes a little closer, and he sees that behind the light there is a, you know, bogie, and behind the bogie there are many bogies. So he says, now I understood the train, and he was leaving. The friend tells him, wait a minute, there is something more. And the train comes at parks in the station, and people get in, get out, people get in, and he sees so many things. Then he understands what a train is. So similarly, people who do not have complete understanding of who God is, when they understand that there is a light emitting from his body, they do not understand anything more than God is light. And that satisfaction of seeing the light is so nice because it is beyond the material world. And that gives people pleasure, and they don't want anything more. Right? That is the first step in understanding God. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavan iti shabdyate. The second step in understanding God is that God is not just light. He has a Paramatma aspect also. That means he is situated in every heart as the Paramatma. That is one step higher than understanding God as light. But the highest is understanding that God is a person from whom the light emits, who is capable of exchanging relationships, rasas, with all of us. You can be his father, you can be his mother, you can be his brother, you can be his friends. You can exchange relationships with the Lord. That is the highest understanding of what God is. not just a person who is an official, you know, person with a beard, old man with a thunderbolt in his hand waiting to strike. No, that's not the description of God which is there in the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is a description of God who is a loving God, who is waiting and eagerly to exchange rasas with us. And so therefore, the Brahma Jyoti is the effulgence of Krishna. Now I'll tell you something more. How Brahma Jyoti is again limited. When somebody performs tapasya and meditates on this Brahma Jyoti, the light aspect of God, Brahman aspect of God, what happens to such a person? Such a person eventually, you know, at the time of his death, when he quits his body, he reaches this place. Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam taje anta kalevaram. That means any person, whatever consciousness you have at the time of death, that is where you reach. So those who are the devotees of the Lord, who are constantly thinking of Krishna, they reach the Golok Vrindavan, the abode of Krishna. Those who are constantly thinking of Lord Ram reached Ayodhya Dham there. Those who are constantly thinking of different incarnations of the Lord reach there. Those who are the devotees of Lord Shiva, they reach the abode of Lord Shiva. But those who are meditating on the light aspect of God, where do they reach? They reach the Brahma Jyoti. And what is Brahma Jyoti? Brahma Jyoti is nothing but light. There is no place, there is no activity there. And there is no form of the Lord over there. So such a place is like a parking lot. It's like, you know, you find big, huge parking lots and multi-story parking lots. It's like you go and park your vehicle in one place. So the vehicle will stand over there for years and years and years, right? So anybody who gets Brahman, who meditates on the Brahman effulgence, and he gets, this is called moksha or mukti in the traditional understanding. This is called merging into God. They go and park themselves over there. And something very interesting. When the Lord appears in this material world and he kills demons, Ravana, Kumbhakarna, so many of these demons he kills, all of them also get liberation. And all of them also end up in Brahma Jyoti. So that means, if somebody is performing years and years of tapasya and ultimately reaching Brahman effulgence, you know, ultimately merging into the Brahman effulgence of God, and he is asleep over there, he might get up and see next to him Ravan. And on the other side of him, you know, he might find Kumbhakaran. So that means, what is the end result of achieving Brahma Jyoti is available for the demons whom the Lord kills. Right? And more than that, just like if you travel on a spaceship and the spaceship doesn't have a place to land. You know, so the spaceship goes, you know, traveling in the air for a long, long time and it doesn't get a place to land. What does it do? It comes back to the earth. So similarly, when somebody goes to Brahman effulgence, there's nothing there. There's no activity. There's no dynamism. The nature of the soul is to be active. The nature of the soul is to do something, right? But unfortunately, there's nothing there. So after some time, those who go and merge into Brahman effulgence, they realize that this is not a very comfortable place. This is not a place where I can express my emotions. This is not a place where I can experience bliss. There is a lot of satisfaction there, but this is not a place where you can be actively satisfied. So such people end up coming back into the material world. So therefore, that is a very unsafe zone to be in. Now, let us come to where we are. This is home sweet home. This is the material world. Welcome to the material world. So, interestingly, the material world is like a big egg. It is called Brahmand. And this egg is a very interesting format. So when the material world is created, I'm going to recall your understanding of the Big Bang theory. And I'm going to explain it from the scriptural understanding. And see what makes more sense logically. So if you remember, yesterday I was discussing about Mahavishnu, this huge personality who is an incarnation of the incarnation of the incarnation of the incarnation of Lord Krishna. From Krishna, Balramji appears. From Balramji, The VSPA, Vasudeva Sankarshan Pradyumna Nirudha appear from them, from Sankarshan Narayan appears, from Narayan secondary VSPA appear, and from secondary Sankarshan comes the personality called Mahavishnu. Now Mahavishnu is there. If you see right on top, you can see this personality. He is Mahavishnu. So now he is the incarnation of the incarnation of the incarnation of the Lord, and he is entering into the material world. So he is the first personality who enters into the material world. And he is huge, gigantic. And as soon as he enters, there is nothing at this point of time. Even these universes, none of these things exist when he enters. And as soon as he enters, from his body, from the pores of his body, he perspires. And when he perspires, when we perspire, what comes out? Sweat. You know, smelling, stinking. But when Mahavishnu perspires, what comes out is milk. And then milk covers 3/4 of this material universe. It covers 3/4 of the material universe. And Lord Mahavishnu is lying in that particular milk ocean. It is called as the causal ocean, or it is also called a Karana ocean. Therefore, one of the names of Mahavishnu is also Karana Udaka Shai Vishnu. Udaka means Karana means causal, and Karana. And Udaka Shai Vishnu means the one who is sleeping in the causal ocean, and from whom this, you know, the milk ocean has actually come out. Now, something very interesting happens. I'm going to tell you the scale of that. You know, later when we talk about the time factor, you know, then you'll understand exactly what I mean by the scale of what is going to happen now. Once the ocean is there and Mahavishnu is lying on it, he starts breathing. What he does? He breathes. And when he breathes out, from every pore of his body, what comes out is one universe. From every pore of Mahavishnu's body, what comes out? One universe. So if the Big Bang Theory is talking about one point, that point is Mahavishnu's pore. One universe coming out, right? Very similar. So now they say that I cannot explain what that point is. But the scriptures say the point is Mahavishnu's pore. And I'll tell you something more. The Big Bang Theory, the latest addition to the Big Bang Theory, this is something you can verify through scientists, is something called the Kessler Theory. What it is called? The Kessler Theory. According to the Kessler Theory, this is purely science, this is nothing concerned with scriptures. According to the Kessler Theory, they say that the Big Bang happened from a point, but they say the point is not a static point. The point is a dynamic point, in the sense that the point contracts and expands, contracts and expands. This is scientists. And what is happening here? Mahavishnu's body, the pores, he's breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. When he breathes out, the universes emit, and when he breathes in, the universes enter back into him. So when science is saying you have faith on the point, we are saying have faith on Mahavishnu. It is the same thing. Faith you have to have, whether you have it from the point perspective or whether you have it from Mahavishnu's perspective. But if you have it from Mahavishnu's perspective, there is unlimited more things we can understand. But if you have it from the point perspective, there is only, you know, questions. So when Lord Mahavishnu emits unlimited universes from his body, every universe is just like this. I'm just taking one of the universes out of the unlimited universes. Okay? So let us analyze this one universe from the unlimited universes. Then you will understand all of the other universes also. So now, once Mahavishnu expands into all these universes, then what he does is that he expands into a personality called Garbha Udaka Shai Vishnu. This is the person called Garbha Udaka Shai Vishnu. So that means one Mahavishnu is expanding into unlimited Garbhodak Shai Vishnus. That means in every universe there is one Garbhodak Shai Vishnu. This universe has one, this universe has one, that universe has one. Every universe has one Garbhodak Shai Vishnu. And so let us just study this universe. I'm going to go a little faster. So as soon as Garbhodak Shai Vishnu comes into the universe, this is one material universe. There are unlimited such material universes. As soon as he comes in, what he does is that again he breathes out. He perspires, and from his perspiration comes out an ocean, which is called Garbhodak Shai Ocean. And this ocean covers 3/4 of this universe. Okay. And then Garbhodak Shai Vishnu is resting on that ocean, on a snake bed. And while he is resting, from his navel comes out a lotus stem. You see this lotus stem? From the navel comes out a lotus stem. On top of that is a lotus flower. And that lotus flower is the home of Brahmaji. So on top of the lotus flower, the first person, first living entity is born, who is Lord Brahma. And when Brahma is born, just imagine his situation. It's a huge lotus, but he is alone. Everything else is dark in the universe because there is no creation that has happened till then. Everything is dark. Brahmaji is alone. He doesn't know what is happening. The only thing he can see is darkness everywhere, and he can see waves of the ocean hitting the snake bed. And when the waves hit, just imagine you go on a dark night to a beach and the waves are hitting the rock. It creates a tremendous sound, right? So Brahmaji, he started getting scared. He became very fearful because he was not knowing what is happening. He didn't know who he was. He didn't know why he is born there. And he didn't know what is that sound that is coming from the ocean. So he tried to move around the lotus flower, trying to find, you know, what is happening. But he was completely scared. At that time, he heard one word. The first syllable uttered, the word was tapaha. Tapaha, which means perform meditation, perform tapasya. So Brahmaji sat down on that lotus flower and he started meditating. And while he was sitting down, he heard the breathing of Garbhodak Shai Vishnu. Through the breathing, just the sound of the breath of Lord Vishnu, all the Vedas entered into the ears of Lord Brahma. And he understood what was his role as a creator, as a secondary creator, and he understood what he is supposed to do. And then Brahmaji got up. And then he started the process of creation. That's why he's called as the engineer of the universe. So then he made 14 planetary systems. You're not able to see it in detail, but these are 14 planetary systems. The middle planetary system is called as Bhuloka. That is where we are situated. And above the Bhuloka, there are 7 planets. And below the Bhuloka, there are 7 planets. Bhuloka is kind of a middle planetary system. The higher planets are called Swargalokas. That means, you know, the different layers of Swarga also. And as they go closer to the lotus, the level of the people who stay in these layers are more intelligent, more pure, more sophisticated, and more having a higher consciousness. So the most qualified living entities stay in the higher planets. And the lower planets are called as the Narkalokas. And these are also 7 in number. You know, Rasatal, Talatal, Sutala, Vitala, you know, Patal, like that. And these layers, as you go lower, you'll find people more and more and more degraded in their consciousness. As you go higher, you'll find people more elevated in their consciousness, and as you go lower, you find people degraded in their consciousness. But the earth, the middle one, which is called Bhuloka, people can be good, can be bad. I'll talk about age spans, then you'll understand more what I mean by good and bad. And the Bhuloka, and I'll just tell you in essence about what, how these planetary systems are. Of course, you can discuss great details, we don't have the time to do that now. But in essence, these planets are not round, just, you know, one planet like that. They are phases, and these are 4-dimensional in nature. Every universe has one Brahmaji, and according to the number of heads of Brahmaji, the dimensions of the universe are determined. In our universe, Brahmaji has four heads. There are universes in which Brahmaji has multiple heads, 100 heads, 1,000 heads. That means the number of dimensions in different universes are bigger. So we can't even cope up with four dimensions, you know, because we don't have access to four dimensions, being human beings. But the higher demigods have access to higher dimensions. So Brahmaji, so this universe is four dimensional. So it's like a phase in which Earth is one planet. And in that planet, we stay. And the higher planets are the Swargalokas. And the lower planets are the Naraklokas. And something more interesting about this universe, you'll find this person here. This is Durga Devi. And you'll find another personality here. This is Lord Shiva. He is an expansion of the Sadashiv from there. So in every universe, there is one Lord Shiva. And in every universe, there is one Durga Devi. Now, I will just tell you about Lord Shiva, then you'll understand connections and the authenticity of this whole structure. If you remember, when Lord Vamanadeva appeared, he was on this planet, the earth planet, and he raised up his leg. And when he raised up his leg, he covered all the, you know, the Swargalokas, and he reached the covering of this universe. Right? His leg reached the covering of the universe. And his leg touched the covering of the universe, the shell. And what happened? The shell broke. And when the shell broke, what is outside the shell? The milk ocean. The milk ocean started entering from there because the shell broke. Now, can you imagine, you know, if you have an egg and one small hole is there in the egg and an ocean is flooding into it, what will happen? Everything will get destroyed, right? So at that point of time, Lord Shiva appeared and he took the initial thrust of the milk ocean on his head. And then it kind of started directing into a small trickle. And that trickle became Ganga. So it entered through the Lord Brahma's planet and it came to the Swargaloka. And when it reached Swargaloka, the same Ganga is called as Mandakini Ganga. And from Swargaloka, it entered into the earth planet. Where did it enter into the earth planet? This is in Gomukh, in Badrinath. If anybody goes to Gomukh now also, there is one particular cave from which the Ganga is actually originating. And that cave is the shape of a cow, cow's mouth. And the scientists have tried to trace beyond the cave where the Ganga is coming from. But how many ever expeditions have gone, they have never returned back. Why? Because beyond that place, it reaches the heavenly planets. And in heavenly planets, you cannot barge in without qualification. Right? So therefore, the source of the Ganga is from the heavenly planets, which is from the milk ocean. And then from here, the earth planet, the Ganga goes to the lower planets also. When it comes to the lower planets, it is called as Bhogavati. It goes lower also. So that from that you can understand the authenticity of the structure of the universe. Anyway, let me go and explain one more concept. So tomorrow, when I'm going to explain to you the connection between the spiritual world and the material world, I will show you something which I'm not going to explain to you now. This is a very hidden concept which I'll tell tomorrow. Somebody can remind me. But in essence, let me just conclude. This is a spiritual world which is like a lotus flower. In the middle of the lotus flower, there is a world in which Lord Krishna's planet is there, Golok Vrindavan. And the below it, there is Dwarka Dham, Mathura Dham, then Ayodhya Dham. And then the spiritual world, the places are like on a petal, lotus petal. And then below that, there is a Vaikuntha planets, unlimited planets of different incarnations of the Lord. And below that, there is Brahma Jyoti. And in that is Kailash, the mountain of Lord Shiva. And Brahma Jyoti is the effulgence of the Lord, which is the light emitting from Lord Krishna's body. And then we find in the material world, you find that Mahavishnu enters, he emits the milk ocean, and from Mahavishnu's pores come out universes. And in every universe, Mahavishnu enters as Garbhodaksha Vishnu, expands, and Lord Brahmaji is born. Brahmaji creates the 14 planetary systems, and Lord Shiva and Durga Devi are there. Lord Shiva is in charge for destruction, and he's also in charge for taking care of people who are of lower consciousness, the mode of ignorance. And Durga Devi is like a jail keeper that we will discuss. So this is the understanding from the spiritual and material world. Now, if we understand that there is a spiritual world, why did Lord create the material world? And why did he create it to be Dukkhalayam? So in any city, whenever we do a planning of any city, we find that, you know, every city needs, you know, research centers, you need hospitals, you need universities, you need playing grounds, you need shopping malls, you need gardens, you know, you need, what are these things? Theaters. You need amazing roads, you need stations, you need, you know, aerodromes, but you also need a prison house. Now, generally, prison house. Generally, every city has a prison house. But the interesting part is the prison house productive? It's quite unproductive in nature, but it occupies a huge place in the city. Many times the center of the city has a prison house, which is like really big in size. If only instead of having a prison house, you could have a, you know, a shopping center, or you could have a ground, it would be so nice. But still, why do we have a prison house? The reason we have a prison house is because there will be people who will be, you know, criminals, who will have a criminal mindset. And what is the need for a prison house? The need for the prison house, the first reason why we need a prison house is for rectification. And the second reason why we need a prison house is so that there is punishment which is there, and sometimes pain. Now, why punishment and pain is given? Because some people need pain and punishment to rectify themselves. Some people need counseling, some people need guidance to rectify themselves, but some people do not understand without pain and punishment. Therefore, the material world offers pain in the form of birth, old age, disease, death, and also in the form of adhyatmik, adhibhautik, and adhidevik miseries. These are the punishments offered in the material world. And every prison has a jailer who makes sure that the criminals don't escape. So this material world has also a jailer who is Durga Devi. And Durga Devi's role is a thankless task. Thankless role. Why? Durga Devi is one of the energies of the Lord. She is not, you know, somebody who is, you know, like the very hard-hearted jailer type. Now, she's a very soft-hearted person because she's a devotee of the Lord. But in spite of being soft-hearted, she has a job of being really hard-hearted. Why? Because she doesn't want any unauthorized person to enter into the spiritual world. So what she does is that she makes sure that only the person who is really qualified, really pure, and really capable of, you know, living a life in the spiritual world can exit from this jail. And material world is a jail, is like a prison house. But it's a very funny prison house. Why it is a funny prison house? Because this is a prison house without walls. No walls in the prison house. But the funny thing in the prison house is that nobody wants to leave this prison house. Everybody is happy staying here, right? We know it is a prison house, but we love it, right? So therefore, this is one of the tasks of Durga Devi, to make sure that people love this place. And therefore, one of her names is also Maya. Maya means that which is not. So she creates unlimited illusions for us to be happy in this prison house. We are tied with chains, but we are happy to be tied. Right? So the way Durga Devi punishes the criminals in this prison house is using her Trishul. We have seen Trishul so many times in the temples. But what is the meaning of this Trishul? Very interesting. The Trishul, the three spokes, signify adhyatmik, adhidevik, and adhibhautik miseries. And Durga Devi is constantly poking us with one of them. She turns it like this, turns it like this, turns it like that. And she's poking us with one of the three. Why? Why is she poking us with one of the three? To remind us that you are not supposed to be here. to remind us that you have something, you have to go somewhere else. That is her service. But in spite of, you know, wanting to remind us, but she doesn't let us go when we want to go. Why? Because she wants to test that only the best one can go. And another part of her role is that whenever, just like in a prison house, we find criminals, some criminals who are very good, they are given some responsibility. You know, somebody who is really good, he is given responsibility of 100 criminals. You know, take care of all of them. Somebody who is really very good, he is given responsibility of more. So some living entity who is very good, he is given administrative roles in this universe. He gets the position of one of the demigods. And he gets to execute responsibility on behalf of the Lord. And when somebody really qualifies, and he is qualified enough to go back to the spiritual world, he is given sanction to enter in the spiritual world. So till then, the material universe is like a solid prison house which holds us down. And now, where did we come back, come to the prison house from? We came from the spiritual world that we saw. Now, what was the crime that we did for which we came down? This is like a question that everybody wants to know. That I seem to be such a good person. It didn't seem that I've done anything wrong. You know, what is the crime that I did? The answer to the question is very simple. The crime that all of us have committed is that of independence from God. We wanted to be independent from God. In the sense that we wanted to enjoy like God in the spiritual world. Just like if there's a driver driving a car of a owner, and the driver is, you know, cooperating with the owner nicely. The owner tells him, put on this music. The driver puts it on. The owner tells him, put on the AC at this speed. You know, he puts it on. He does everything what the master tells. But one day, suddenly he goes off. And, you know, the master tells him, put on this music. He says, no, I want to hear rock and roll today. And he puts on bang, 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 big music. The owner tells him, take me to, you know, Kolaba. He says, no, I'm in a mood of going to Borivali. And he takes him to the Borivali, you know. So, what will the master do? He can do, you know, the driver can do whatever he wants as long as he's driving. But once he gets out from the car, that is the last time he's going to enter the car, right? So similarly, the Lord is the controller and the creator. And he's also the enjoyer. But in the spiritual world, only the Lord enjoys. And everybody is a participant in facilitating and aiding the Lord to enjoy. And while doing that, we also get enjoyment. Just like if when the driver is driving the master, he also can hear the music. It is not that the master is telling him, put a earplug, you should not hear. You know, you put a kumbal, you can't hear, experience the AC. It's not like that. When somebody is serving, he gets facilities also. So similarly, when all of us serve the Lord, you also get enjoyment. But if somebody says, I want to enjoy like him, then is the problem. Therefore, when somebody says, I want to enjoy independent of God, then the Lord sends him to the material world. And here, all of us, every living entity, is trying to become tiny gods, tiny controllers, trying our best to somehow or the other enjoy like God in the spiritual world. So therefore, in every human being, every living entity, there's this mindset of wanting to become like God. May not be as powerfully, but at least partially. Just like there was one child, you know, one girl. She came to her mother, she was a very small girl. She told her mother that I want to do cooking today. I want to, you know, cook for all of y'all. The mother said, you can't cook, you're too small. She said, no. He said, I want to cook. So the mother, she takes the trouble of going out and getting a full-fledged kitchen set. She gets a plastic stove, plastic gas cylinder, plastic vegetables, plastic knife, everything plastic. And the girl, she becomes extremely happy and she starts cooking. She cooks for 3 hours, cutting vegetables, cooking the rice, cooking the dal, cooking chapati, cooking sabji. Then after 3 hours of extremely tiresome cooking, she runs to the mother and tells her, I'm feeling hungry. The mother tells her, you cook for 3 hours, why don't you eat? The child tells, no, I want food. Mother tells her, you eat what you cooked. She says, no, I want real food. Then the mother gives her the real food. Similarly, all of us were acting like that girl. In the kingdom, in the spiritual world, we told God, we want to enjoy like you. We want to cook, we want to cook, we want to cook. God tells us, you cannot cook. Why don't you enjoy what is here? Why don't you enjoy? He says, no, I want to cook like you. So Krishna is a very merciful person. He creates a world where each one has a space to try cooking. So people come to the material world, we are sent to the material world, and each living entity is trying his best to set up an empire and cook his own food. You know, somebody tries to build a big business, somebody tries to build a nice family, somebody tries to do this, somebody tries to do that. Enjoying in the way God is enjoying in the spiritual world. Controlling in the way God is controlling in the spiritual world. And trying to become a proprietor in the way God is a proprietor in the spiritual world. And then after years and years and lifetimes of trying to enjoy like that, at some point we come to a Gita course. At some point we come to a point where we think that let me, you know, experience real enjoyment now. I've tried enough of enjoying in the way I want to. I've tried enough in thinking that this is what is going to give me enjoyment. I've tried enough and I've seen enough. Now let me experience real enjoyment. And then he comes back to the mother or the father and tells her that please give me food. Please give me real enjoyment. I'm hankering for this real enjoyment. And then God mercifully gets us back to the spiritual world. And the process of coming back to God is a process of taking shelter. It's a process of keeping our ego aside and saying, now I have decided, bahut ho gaya. I'll come back. You know? Just like Jesus Christ tells the story of this prodigal son. There was a very rich man who had two sons. And these two sons had, the father was very, very rich. And both these sons, they were nice boys. But one of them, he told his father, he got bad friends. And he told his father, give me half my property right now. I want to go away from you. And I want to live life the way I want. So the father, he tried to tell him, what's wrong with you? You have everything here. Why don't you just help me? The son said, no, nothing doing. I want to enjoy in my way. So the father, what he can do? He divides the share, gives half the property to his elder son, half the property to his second son. Second son goes, happy with unlimited money now. He goes and somehow when somebody has everything, too many people, and too many relatives around. And therefore, the word relative is a very relative word. So he had a lot of friends, a lot of company, and people all around him. So he was happy. But slowly, 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 over a period of time, he lost everything. And when he lost everything, he realized, you know, now what should I do? All his friends disappeared. Thin air, you know, as if they never existed. And then he started thinking, I made a big mistake. But now, how can I go back to my father? So he said, let me work somewhere. But what can he work? He tried to search for a job. Nobody was giving him. Then finally, he went to a farmer's house. And the farmer told him, you can take care of my pigs. And this man said, anything, you know, please give me some food. He said, whatever the pigs eat, the same food you also eat. Some fodder. So this man was living with the pigs in the pig house and eating the food that the pig is eating. And then all the time he was remembering his father. Remembering, you know, the kindness of his father. Then he said, you know, too much. Let me go back to my father and I will become a servant in his house. I will not ask for property. I will not ask for any facility. I will become a servant in his house. Even the servant in my father's house get better facility than this. He went back. And as soon as the father heard that my son is returned back and is in the, you know, the start of the village, he ran all the way to meet his son. And the son, he saw his father, he felt so ashamed. He couldn't look at him. The father embraced him. He's kissing him. And he said, thank you, son, you come back. The son said, I don't want to be your son now. I want to be a servant. The father said, what are you talking about? You are my son. He said, no, I've done wrong. I want to be your servant. The father said, you are my son eternally. Come back. And then he lived happily with his father. Similarly, we are like that prodigal son who at some point wanted father's property. Father gave us the material world. And the remaining sons are there in the spiritual world. And we felt that we are going to enjoy life in a very unique way here. We tried our best. And relationships don't last for long. Friendships are almost meaningless, you know, with so much selfish passions. Life of enjoyment, wealth, money, so many things, gives hardly any satisfaction. And at some point of time, when everyone gets this realization that I've tried too much, let me try something else. Let me try going back to my father. That is the time when the father is not saying, hey, so many days, where were you? You know, he says, welcomes us back to the spiritual world. So the sin that we committed is the sin of criming. This is the story of the prodigal son. And then as soon as you come to the prison house, the first thing that happens is you get a change of clothes. And that is the number of species, different bodies, the material bodies. So you get a material gross body and you get a subtle body, which is the change of garments. And the scriptures explain the exact number of species which exist. It says, Jalaja Navalakshani, 9 lakh species of aquatics. It says, trees, that is called, they call as Thavara. Thavara means table. Trees are 20 lakh trees. Krimi means reptiles, 11 lakh reptiles. Pakshi means birds, 10 lakh birds. Pashu means animals, 30 lakh animals. And Manava means human beings, 4 lakh human beings, which comes to a total of 84 lakh species of life, 8,400,000 species. Now, what is the meaning of species? It means levels of consciousness. And the species is determined according to the development of the central nervous system. You know, according to the more developed your central nervous system is, the higher your consciousness is. The lowest developed central nervous system is of trees, and the highest developed central nervous system is of human beings. And among human beings, now something very interesting. What is the meaning of 4 lakh human beings? You know, we can understand 9 lakh aquatics and all the others. What do you mean of 4 lakh human beings?
4 lakh types.
Types. According to one's consciousness. That means even among human beings there is gradation in consciousness. You find some human beings in the jungles of Africa almost like animals. And you find some human beings more sophisticated, more refined, more gentlemanly. And you'll find some human beings really qualified, that are the demigods. The highest qualified human being is Lord Brahma. That is the 4 lakh species we're talking about. So similarly, every animal or every bird, every plant has number of species according to consciousness. And the whole cycle is development of consciousness over a period of time. That means in the lower species, as you go from the lower species to the species of human being, I was giving this example, it is like going on a highway. You know, when you go on a highway, you're just marching forward. So when the lower species of, you know, the trees, whatever, that they die, the next body that they get is one level higher in consciousness. That means one level higher in the development of the central nervous system. And as the species progress, slowly, 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 they only go forward. They never go backwards. That means animals, whatever they do, they never get reaction to whatever they do. And this, you know, this, I was talking about this shloka of Yamyam Vapi Smaran Bhavam, whatever you remember at the time of death, that determines your next birth. Na? That doesn't apply to animals and the lower species. It only applies to human beings. So human life is like a junction where you can take a U-turn or you can go ahead. So those human beings who take a U-turn, they decide, you know, too much of human life, let me go back a little bit. They come back to the animal life. Take a U-turn and join back somewhere in between, according to the desire. And from there, they continue ahead. Again, same thing. Punarapi mananam, punarapi jananam. The cycle goes on. But somebody who comes in the human life and says, I want to go ahead. Such a person develops in his consciousness. And that is the struggle between the animal life and 4 lakh species of human life. That means we are somewhere in between the 4 lakh species. Our task is to become from 0 in the 4 lakh species to the 4th lakh person and go back. Or find a way from wherever we are, jump off. Right? That is what we need to do as human beings. Therefore, I said, human life is like a junction. You need to decide where to go. So therefore, the prisoner, the first thing that he has done is given a dress. And he wears a dress. And as soon as he wears a dress, something very unique happens. When the spirit soul, that is the Atma which is coming from the spiritual world, comes to the material world, he is given a suit, which is his birthday suit. Happy birthday. And as soon as he is born, everybody around him convinces him that you are the body. First thing, the parent, so much love, so much affection showering on the child. The child starts thinking, hey, I am special. I am a special soul come into this world only to enjoy. And the child begins his consciousness of thinking that I am the enjoyer from day one. And then that is, you know, escalated as time passes. As he gets more degrees, he feels, wow, I'm more special. As he gets married with a beautiful lady, he feels, I'm even more special. As he gets a child, he feels, I'm even more special. As time passes, he finds that I'm more and more and more special. And then when the time of death comes, he says, how can I live? I'm so special. And with that consciousness, he cannot get detached. So therefore, the dress, the material body is like a shackle, is like a dress, but this dress kind of binds us to this world, feeling that I am not the spirit soul, but I am the material body. And then the prisoner is bound up by shackles. And what are these shackles in this material world? They are the three modes of material nature. These three modes of material nature, they are the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance, and the mode of goodness. And these three modes bind us. And we are bound by these three modes. And the way in which these three modes operate is they kind of capture every aspect of our life. The way we eat. Music can be according to the three modes. Somebody who is in the mode of ignorance likes to hear music, you know, of a certain type. Somebody who is in the mode of passion likes to hear really loud banging music. Somebody in the mode of goodness likes to hear instrumental soft music. Somebody who is in the mode of passion likes to eat food spicy. When it goes in, burning. When it comes out, it is burning. Somebody with a mode of ignorance likes to eat food that is, you know, putrid or stale or fleshy. Somebody who is in the mode of goodness likes to eat food which is fresh, freshly prepared, hot, not spicy, things like that. Somebody who is in the mode of passion likes to have friends of a certain type. Typically, the example is of... So these are the qualities of a person in the mode of goodness. The person in the mode of goodness exhibits purity, knowledge, and freedom from sin. Person in the mode of passion, he exhibits unlimited desires and obsessed with lust. Person in the mode of ignorance exhibits intoxication, laziness in sleep, and delusion. Delusion means no sense of direction. Within the same family, people can be in three different modes. Here is a typical family. Ravan, mode of passion. Great amount of lust, great amount of desire to accumulate. Kumbhakaran, mode of ignorance. 6 months sleep, eating all kinds of abominable things and drinking all kinds of abominable things. And Vibhishan, the mode of goodness, being able to make the right decisions, having clarity of thought, having freedom from sin. So it's not that, you know, in one family, people have to be in the same mode. And these three modes are kind of, and it's not that we always have one mode acting. We always have a combination of modes. Just like, you know, in any food preparation, you have some spice, some haldi, some vegetables having certain color. It's a mixture of all these. So every human being is a mixture of these modes. Sometimes the mode of passion is prevalent. Sometimes the mode of goodness is prevalent. Sometimes the mode of ignorance is prevalent. They're fighting against each other to take dominance. And depending on the food you eat, depending on the people you associate with, depending on the music that you hear, depending on the type of books that you read, and depending on the type of friends that you have, your mode changes. And one can grow from the mode of ignorance to the mode of goodness. And one can grow beyond the mode of goodness also. Now, something very interesting. I'll tell you how to understand the modes with the help of an example. And I'll tell you something which can be like a catch in the modes also. The example is of a hat seller. One time one hat seller, he went to sell his hats to a certain village. On his way, he went to sleep under a tree. And then when he got up, he saw that there were so many monkeys taking all their hats, you know, and they were like, you know, creating a hell. This man got frustrated and he started abusing the monkeys and he started, you know, yelling at the monkeys. And then he finally realized that I can't do much. He tried to run after them. He couldn't do it. So then he started crying and he went away. So this person is the person in the mode of passion. He reacts as if he is the controller. He reacts as if that he can achieve something with his own efforts. Then the next person came with another set of hats and he sat on under the same tree. And the monkeys took away his hats also. And when he got up, he saw that the monkeys have taken his hats. He said, he felt, I'm so helpless, what can I do? He started crying and he walked away from there. This is a person in the mode of ignorance, feeling lazy and delusion. Delusion in the sense that not having a sense of direction and feeling completely helpless. And third person who came, he came with a set of hats. He slept, the monkeys took his hats away. And when he got up, he realized all the monkeys have his hats. So what he did, he took his hat and he threw it on the ground. And all the monkeys threw their hats on the ground. He picked up all the hats and went home. This is a person in the mode of goodness. Clarity of thought, not getting too wild, not getting too dejected, but being practical. But the catch is that even the mode of goodness is bad. Now, I'll ask you all a question. Ignorance is bad understood. Passion is bad understood. Why is the mode of goodness bad? Any idea? Develops pride. One. Anything else? Yeah, what is that? Selfishness, yes. She got the point. The mode of goodness means you have golden chains on. Somebody who lives a life based on the mode of goodness, what is his life? He does everything first class, no sin committed. But the point is, the mode of goodness can also be captivating. You know why? What does the mode, different modes lead to? The mode of ignorance leads to lower species. You know, you go to the hellish planets or you take a lower birth. Mode of passion leads to elevation in species. You don't go to the species in the mode of ignorance, but you end up in mode of passion. Passion means creation. Creation means rebirth. Right? The thought that I am the doer, that is the mode of passion permanently. The mode of goodness is clarity of thought, sinlessness. That means higher elevation in life. That means you either get to take birth in a very good human species or you get to take birth in heavenly planets. But the cycle of birth, death, old age, disease doesn't go away. You get birth, but you get birth. So the mode of goodness is also a problem. So therefore, all the three modes are chains which bind us here to this world. Therefore, we want to avoid all the three chains. Now, this is the most important, it's a very interesting part. It's called Kala, or the eternal time factor. So, time is one factor that never spares anyone. Whatever happens, time is rolling for everyone. And what all of us do with whatever limited time we have determines what is going to happen to us in future. Right? So now I'm going to talk about two types of time cycles. One is called the universal time cycle and the second is called the lifetime cycle. So first thing, the universal time cycle, like this is pertaining to the material universe. If you remember that structure which I showed you, the spiritual and material world, this universal time cycle is only for the material world, right? So now let me explain to you how this time cycle works. So there are four yugas. The first yuga is called the Satya Yuga. The second yuga is called the Treta Yuga. The third yuga is called Dwapara Yuga. And the fourth yuga is called the Kali Yuga. Now, in these four yugas, the personalities who live in these four yugas are different. And the first yuga, the Satya Yuga, are people who are really pure. And the people who are in Kali Yuga are really the left out ones, the most impure ones. And as time passes in Kali Yuga, the people are going to get more and more and more degraded. It's explained in Satya Yuga, people who had demonic qualities and divine qualities, they didn't live in the same planet. So the divine people lived in one planet and the demonic people lived in another planet. And Satya Yuga, people were pious, pure in their lifestyles and very strictly following principles of religion. as the time passed in Treta, okay, the example of Satya Yuga, how demons and divine people lived in different places, is example of Hiranyaksha and Varahadev, you know, and the demigods. Hiranyaksha lived in a different place completely, and you know the demigods lived in a totally different place. And in Treta Yuga, the next yuga, you will find that people become less pure than the ones in Satya Yuga. The height also decreases. The lifespan also decreases. In Satya Yuga, people would live for 1 lakh years. In Treta Yuga, people would live for 10,000 years. And along with size and height and duration of life, also the level of purity would decrease. And in Treta Yuga, the demons and the divine people lived in the same planet. You'll find Lord Ram living in the same planet and Ravan living in the same planet. But they lived on different places of the same planet. But as time passed again, Dwapar Yuga, people decreased more in height and duration of life became 1,000 years. Lord Krishna, when he spoke the Gita, he was 125 years old. Arjun was also 125 years old approximately. That means, and they were young, you know. Of course, Arjun had grandchildren also at that point of time, but he was dynamic. He was fighting in the best of his spirits because he was young compared to 1,000 years of his life. But Dwapar Yuga, the purity level decreased again. And people in the same family who were living together, some were divine, some were demonic. We find that in the Mahabharata. And as time passed again, Kali Yuga, height decreased even more. It's decreasing even more. And more than the height, you'll find that the duration of life is decreasing. At some point of time, if you're living for 100 years, it was normal. But now, 50, 60 years is normal. And in the scriptures, Srimad Bhagavatam describes that as time progresses in Kali Yuga, if somebody lives for 20 years, he'll be considered a grand old woman or a man. Memory decreases. Purity level decreases. That is the age of Kali. And in Kali Yuga, the divine and demonic live in the same person. Every human being has a divine part and a demonic part. And depending on what you nurture, that part comes out. Sometimes the lower nature comes out, sometimes the higher nature comes out. Sometimes you find that I am not so bad, but why am I acting so bad? Right? Because the demonic tendency has come up. But if you want to understand the calculation of time, it is like this. Kali Yuga is the shortest duration, is 4,32,000 years. That means right now we have passed 5,000 years of Kali Yuga. And we have 4,27,000 years left for complete dissolution to happen. I'll tell you some more things as we progress. Dwapar Yuga is double of Kali Yuga, 8,64,000 years. Treta Yuga is 3 times Kali Yuga, 12,96,000 years. And Satya Yuga is 4 times Kali Yuga, 17,28,000 years. And these 4 yugas put together is called one Chatur Yuga, which is 43,20,000 years. And now I'm coming to lifespans of different personalities. Lord Brahma lives one Chatur Yuga multiplied by 1,000 is 1 day of Lord Brahma, 12 hours. And that much is the duration of Lord Brahma's night, 12 hours. So you can imagine Brahma lives such, you know, this 1 day, multiply that into 30 is 1 month, multiply that into 12 is 1 year. He lives such 100 years. So when we say the demigods have no, I mean, they don't die, this is what it means. They live for millions and millions of years compared to us. Like an ant, you know, compared to a human being. The ant lives for a few days. And when the ant sees a human being, the human being never dies for the ant. There are living entities who live for a few seconds. And within that few seconds, they have a house, they have a, you know, they have a bank balance, they have a wife, they have children, they have grandchildren, and they die also. Few seconds. By the time you wink your eyes and open, one, you know, generation has passed away of one living entity. But for the demigods, by the time they wink their eyes and open, one human generation has passed away. Time is relative in this world, right? And therefore, when we understand Brahmaji's life, you can understand much more. So Brahmaji, that means every Brahmaji has 100 years of his life. And every Brahmaji, 12 hours of his day, he's active, he's managing. But the 12 hours of his night, he's sleeping. So whenever Brahmaji goes to sleep, the universe, the whole creation, gets completely annihilated. Completely annihilated. That means the water of the Garbhodakshaya ocean completely dissolves all the structure that he has created. That means, just see Brahmaji's job description. Every day when he gets up in the morning, there is nothing in creation. He has to start everything again. Creating the 14 planetary systems. Creating all the living entities. And then when he goes to sleep in the night, everything is dissolved. So nobody is without any work in this world. Everybody has enough service, right? And that means whenever Brahmaji sleeps, there is a dissolution that happens. That means there are many times Brahmaji sleeps little in the day also. He takes little winks. And whenever Brahmaji, you know, takes a little dose, there is a partial dissolution that happens in this world. So you find many partial dissolutions that happen also within the universe. Those are the times when Brahmaji is dozing off. And when he sleeps in the night, there is a complete dissolution. And in the day, again he has to create. But the most interesting part is what I'm going to tell now. You'll understand who is who with this. Brahmaji lives for 100 years. And when Brahmaji finishes his 100 years, Mahavishnu breathes in. So the one breath of Mahavishnu, so much is happening in this world. That means the material universe, millions and millions of years passing is one breath of Mahavishnu. And Mahavishnu is the expansion of the expansion of the expansion of Lord Krishna. And then you can understand the position of the different living entities. Then you can understand the relative position of the demigods. That means all the demigods also are dissolved when Brahmaji goes to sleep. Every demigod is also dissolved. That means in every universe there are 33 crore demigods, different sets. Every universe has one set of demigods. Different, you know. That means there are unlimited demigods because they are positions, administrative roles. But you'll find that the position of Lord Krishna is an eternal position. What happens in this material world, Krishna is not even bothered about it. Mahavishnu has been delegated that service. Yeah, Mahavishnu is breathing in, breathing out. You know? Krishna has nothing to do with the material world. But once in a while, he comes. Why he comes? He comes to do a trailer. Just like, you know, whenever you advertise a movie, you first run a trailer for days and days and days together. Suddenly one fellow, one head comes up, suddenly one tail comes up, you know. You don't know what's happening. Then you have to see the full movie. So similarly, Lord Krishna, whenever he comes in this world, he comes and does a trailer. One lifetime, 125 years he lives here. He, you know, does a first class trailer, shows beautiful pastimes, and winds up and goes back to the spiritual world. If you want the full movie, come there. Right? That is Lord Krishna's contribution. Therefore, when we see these universal time cycles, we understand who is who and where we are. And then, we are struggling with a lifetime cycle. The time of conception, then there is development of the embryo, then there is birth, then there is the phase of growing, then there is the phase of being a boy, then there is youth, then there is manhood, then there is old age, and then the time of death. This is called the individual life cycle. Now, time is considered to be a great gambler. And how to use the time determines how you are actually living in this world. Because if somebody doesn't know how to use the time, then the time is just gone away. It's wasted. But somebody knows how to use this valuable human life in a very practical way, then he can make the best use of his time. And therefore, that leads us to the process of karma. I'm going to speak about 15 minutes more. I hope this is fine. Now we have kind of set to understand some really powerful things in in this world. So in this world, everyone is completely unique, and we find differences. Some are born very wealthy, some are born handicapped, some are born very handsome, some are born very ugly, some are born with a silver spoon in their mouth, some are born with not even a drop to eat. Some are born, you know, we find innocent children suffering in this world for no reason. And you find so many calamities that are happening, you know, without any practical understanding of why it happens. So then the question that comes up in people's mind is that, why is God so cruel? That brings us to the story of this person. This is called deism. Deism is a concept that God is the creator, but he is not the controller. This is a man, his name is Harold Kushner. This person was a priest, and he wrote this book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And why he wrote this book is because of something that happened in his life. He was a holy man, always worshipping God. But at some point of time in his life, his young son, he had a son about 12 years old, his son got a disease called progeria. This is a disease where a person becomes old when he is very young. So when he was 12 years old, he was looking as if he was 60 years old. Shriveled body, you know, teeth falling off, hair falling off, and in a very bad shape. And when he was 13 years old, his son died. And at that point of time, he wrote this book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. What this book in essence says is like this. His conclusion was that God cannot be all-powerful and all-merciful simultaneously. His understanding was, God may be all-powerful, but he cannot be all-merciful because we see so many suffering around us. And he said that God may be all-merciful, but then not all-powerful. Then if he is, you know, all-merciful and if he's all-powerful also, why doesn't he elevate sufferings in this world? But Krishna's understanding, Krishna's statement is that I am equal to all. Samoham sarvabhuteshu. I am equal to all, Krishna says in the Gita. Now, how do we relate to it? You know, on one instance, we find that, you know, so many situations show that God is not merciful. On the other hand, so many situations show that God is merciful. How do we understand who God is, how God is, and why he does so many different things? The statement that Krishna gives in the Gita is like this. He says, Samoham sarvabhuteshu. I am equal to all. How do you understand it? The first equality of God is in his presence. Krishna is present as a Paramatma in everyone's heart. In the heart of a bad man, in the heart of a good man. In the heart of somebody who is suffering in the roads, somebody who is living in the richest places in the world, somebody who is in the body of an insect, somebody who is in the body of a prestigious animal, he is like a judge. In a court, the judge awards rigorous punishment to one person, and he awards great compensation to another person. Now the question is a judge partial? No. The judge is impartial. What he does, he sees the activity of this person and he sees the law of the nation and he compares the two and he gives an award or he gives a punishment. Just like if somebody goes into a hotel, or I'll give another example. Let me give this hotel example first. Somebody goes into a hotel and he orders for a pizza and he sits down. The moment he has spoken his order, the waiter, he goes and tells the cook a pizza. Cooks the pizza, the waiter comes and serves it. The man eats it, and then the man is walking off. The cashier on the counter, he tells him, money. You have to pay the money for what you have eaten. So now, if you tell the cashier is bad, it doesn't make sense. Because the cashier is neutral. What you have desired and expressed, and what action you have done, you have to pay for it. That's the role of a judge, or that's the role of a cashier. So similarly, God is not partial, but rather, he judges the activities of the individuals, and based on our activity, he gives judgment. And what is the definition of karma? The definition of karma is this: activities performed by the soul in the material body, conditioned by the mode of material nature, under the control and purview of time. Very tough definition. What it essentially means is that whatever you do in this world, through the influence of the modes of material nature, the mode of ignorance, passion and goodness, and under the influence of time factor, you are responsible for those activities. That's what the law of karma means. So, to understand the definition of law of karma, let us answer this. Who am I? I am the spirit soul. Where am I? In the material world. What situation I am in? I am in a material body. What am I bound up by? I am bound up by the three modes. Who is controlling me? The time factor. And who is watching me? The Paramatma. So God is an impartial judge within everyone's heart. And the Lord is a silent observer. And the Lord, He directs the material nature to give us or take away from us according to our actions. So the law of karma is that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. This is Newton's third law. Just like if somebody, you know, kicks the door very badly, you know, that is an action. But what is the reaction? If the door is locked, it rebounds. So just because he kicked the door, he cannot say how the door pushed me back. What action he did, he is getting a reaction for it. So when somebody eats a certain type of food, he knows that the next day what happens to him is depending on what he eats the previous day. You cannot blame the situation. When a farmer, he sows a seed. And now if he sows a brinjal seed, he cannot expect mangoes to grow. And naturally, what will grow is brinjals. Now, if he sows a mango seed, he cannot expect that something else will grow. And depending on what he sows, he reaps. So there is a story of two people. This personality, he was the president of Poland many, many decades back. There's a story in his life which kind of shows us this concept nicely. So when he was an expert piano player, expert. This was much before he became the president of Poland. So one time, there was two students studying in one college in Poland, and they were, and one of them badly needed money because he didn't have money to complete his education. And one of his friends suggested to him, "I will help you get money for your education." He said, "Let us organize a concert. And whatever we organize in the concert, whatever we earn through it, you can live your college life with that money." So these both, they wanted to organize a concert. And then they decided to approach this person. And he agreed to do the concert. And the condition was that he had to pay $2,000 to him as his fee. And then whatever else they earn, they can take. So they organized a huge concert. Thousands of people attended the concert. But what happened was that somehow or the other, they couldn't make enough money. And when they had to pay him $2,000, they only had $1,600. And they went up to him and they told him the situation. And they said that, "We will give you a blank check, of $400, but without a date. And we promise you that we will make sure that we pay you this money." So when this man heard this, he said, "Don't worry. You keep the $1,600 also with you, use it for your college fees." And he went away. And then this man, he went up to become the president of Poland eventually. And at some point of time in the life of, in his duration of presidentship, Poland came across a situation where there was a disaster. Practically no food. There was a certain war going on and there was no food at all. And they desperately needed food. So what he decided to do, he decided to write a letter to the president of the United States requesting him for help. He wrote a letter. He couldn't go there because the situation didn't permit him to go. So the letter reached. And as soon as it reached the president of the United States, he saw that this letter has come from this person. He immediately sanctioned it. And immediately the next day itself, thousands of kilos of food and resources reached Poland. And they were saved from the calamity. And eventually, when things were all right, this man, he came to meet the president and to thank him for what he did. And when he was thanking him, he asked him, what made you take such a big step in, you know, just one request? And then this merchant said, you are the one who helped me when I was a student. He was the same student. And so the point is that the law of karma, it always works at some level. When somebody does something good, it always comes back to him in a very different way, in the way that we would probably never expect. And then it comes to this question that what are the types of karma? There are three types of karma in this world. First type of karma is called karma, which means pious activities. It means if you do something good, you get something good in return. This is generally associated with, you know, at the time of death. If somebody has led a very pious life, he gets heavenly planets in his next life. He gets elevated to heavenly planets. What is the meaning of elevation to heavenly planet? Still being stuck in the cycle of birth and death. Right? So this is good karma. This is pious activities. But still, it doesn't solve the real problems of life. So this is called karma. The second is called as vikarma or sinful activities. Sinful activities take us to lower species of life. These are activities that are, you know, promoting lower consciousness. This is called vikarma. So anybody who does vikarma, sinful activities, he goes to the lower planetary systems, where again the cycle of birth and death is not over. Then there is third thing called akarma, which is called spiritual activities. These are also called as neutral activities, which means that anybody does this, he is neither doing karma nor doing vikarma. That means he is on a different platform, different standard. That means whatever actions he does, he is not going to get any reaction for it. Neither good nor bad. Because both good and bad are bad. Right? This is the fundamentals of Gita. This is a concept, if anybody understands this thoroughly, he has understood the essence of the Gita course. This is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Performing a karma. How to live a life of performing a karma. That means, what does it mean? It means that whatever we do in our lives, if we can live a life according to a karma, we will never get a reaction. That means we are on neutral gear. First gear or higher gears means we are going ahead. Reverse gear means we are going behind. Neutral gear means we are neither going behind nor going backwards. Which means we are flying on a different platform. Right? That is called akarma. How to live a life of akarma is what we are going to discuss tomorrow. Tomorrow's whole discussion is this. Akarma. That is what we are ultimately interested in. Right? But let me not go into details now. So there are different types of karma. Which means the reaction. How the reaction comes to us. It comes in different ways. One is called instant karma. Instant karma is like an ATM machine. If you want cash, you put your card, you get cash immediately. Similarly, when somebody does, and the second type of karma is called delayed karma. It's like a check. It takes some time for you to get the cash. An example of instant karma is, if somebody sows mustard seeds, in little while he gets a plant. But if somebody sows a coconut seed, he has to wait for 10 years to get fruits. Right? This is delayed karma. If somebody, you know, fools around with a lady, immediately gets a slap. You know, instant karma. But if somebody murders somebody else, he may not get a reaction immediately. The court may take a few years to solve the case. It may never solve the case also. But the law of karma will not leave him. It may take his next lifetime for it to fructify. This is called delayed karma. A typical example of delayed karma is in the Mahabharata. It's the life of Dhritarashtra. Now, somebody might ask, why did Dhritarashtra suffer like that? There is a story. Dhritarashtra asks Krishna at the end of the Kurukshetra war, he asks him, why did I suffer? Why did my 100 children die? Krishna told him a story which happened 50 lifetimes back. Krishna told him, 50 lifetimes back, Dhritarashtra was a young king. And he had gone to the forest for hunting. And while he was hunting, he came across, you know, he came across two birds, and he tried to, you know, shoot one of the birds. And when he shot the eye of the bird. and he blinded the bird with his eyes. And then he took the nest of the birds and he burnt the nest. It had 100 eggs and he killed all the children. And then the reaction naturally was that he was born blind. And the reaction also was that he lost his 100 children. But now the question is, why 50 lifetimes? Why 50 lifetimes later? Why not the next lifetime? The answer is that to get one son, you have to do a lot of pious activity. But to get 100 sons together, you have to do unlimited pious activity. It took him 50 lifetimes to accumulate that much pious activity. And when he was exactly ready, the reaction came. So this is called delayed karma. So whatever we do, we are accountable. Then there's something called individual karma. Individual karma means you cannot share your karma. You know, take 50%, I'll take 50%. No. Individual karma means each one is responsible for what action we do. Like for example, Valmiki Muni, before he became Valmiki, his name was Valyakoli. He was a hunter. And his typical style of hunting was that he would half kill animals. He would, you know, kind of kill them and leave them flapping around without being dead. And he would continue killing many, many like that. And one time Narad Muni saw that. He was half killing the animals. He asked him, "Why are you doing this?" He said, "This is my profession. This is what my father has taught me. This is what I do to maintain my family." Narad Muni said, Do you know what is waiting for you?" He said, "I don't know. I don't care also." So Narad Muni, immediately he showed him a PowerPoint presentation. He showed him a vision. He showed him a vision of what is waiting for him in future. He showed him the scenes of hellish torture, what he's going to undergo for what he's doing now. He said, "I can't tolerate this." So Narad Muni said, "Do you want to experience all this?" He said, no, "I don't want to, but what to do? I'm doing it for my family." So Narad Muni told him, "You are doing it for your family. You go and ask your family members whether they will share this sin that you are, doing it for." So he said, "Of course they will share. They're my family members. Of course, I'm doing it for them." He said, "Go and ask." He went running to his wife and his parents and his children. He said that, "I just saw a vision of what is going to happen to me in future. I'm sure all of you all are happy to share, my sins with me." The parents said that, "We have given you so much already and now we are old. Don't expect us to share your sin." And they walked off. The wife said that, "I am your wife. I am supposed to take half your pious, activities, pious credits, but not your sin." And she walked off. And the children said, "We are too small. We have to play." They went to play. And Valmiki realized that he is getting into a big soup. He went running back to Narad Muni and asked him, "What should I do?" And then Narad Muni recommended him to chant the holy names. And then he said, "What will I do for my living?" Narad Muni told him a very simple thing. "If you take shelter of the Lord, he is the one who actually supplies to every living entity. If he can supply an elephant food, 100 kilos of food every day, why can't he supply you?" And Valmiki actually took that to heart. And he actually gave up his profession of being a hunter and he became an exalted sage. So this is individual karma. You cannot share it. And what is collective karma is where people together suffer for a certain action. Now, I'll tell you an example to make us understand this collective karma better. One time, during the tsunami that happened in India many years back, there were some people who went scuba diving on that day in the ocean. And when they were scuba diving, they were looking for something under the water, they found suddenly a pressure, coming on them. And they tried to resist the pressure and they were diving. And then after some time, they came out. And when they came out, they came to the shore. There was no shore only. So that means while the tsunami happened, they were inside the water and nothing happened to them. And people who were outside the water, everyone died. So collective karma means that a certain number of people who are of a certain type, who have done a certain type of sin, are brought together and something happens. And then all of them, have to suffer for it together because of a similar type of action. Now, again, that brings us to a question that, how do we handle? That means, should we say if everybody died together in a fire accident and all of them, collective karma, they deserve it? Is that the way we react? No. We react with a certain amount of compassion, with understanding that everyone is responsible for his action. We understand the philosophy. But the application of the philosophy has to be dealt in a very, very empathic way. In the way that they are suffering and I'm compassionate for their suffering. I'm wanting to help them elevate from the suffering, but with also the wisdom that we know why the suffering is happening. And with the wisdom that if I continue performing the same sins, I will also end up in the same suffering. The wisdom is there, but the dealing is with the compassion. What karma, what the theory of karma does, it makes us responsible for our action. But at the same time, it doesn't make us, you know, become cynic towards the actions of others. You see the actions of others and the reaction that come into their life with compassion, and you see the reaction that comes into your life and your own action with responsibility. That is what the law of karma is. It's not just that, you know, whenever you see something going wrong, you start blaming people, you know, that you have done so much sin. But rather, you see it from your point of view, that I am also responsible for every action that I do. And if I do the wrong action, I will also get a reaction. That's what the law of karma does. And the next question is, what if I don't know the law of karma? Will it still act on me? One time, one villager came to Bombay and he was traveling in a local train. He bought a ticket, entered the train and he sat down. The TC came and asked him for his ticket. He showed his ticket. The TC said, you have to pay a fine. He said, I have a ticket. He said, you're sitting in first class. He said, I don't know. The TC told him, ignorance of the law is no excuse. So even if you don't know the law of karma is going to act. Our responsibility as a human being is to study the instruction manual. Without studying the instruction manual, if you act, then the manufacturer is not responsible for bad use of the product. So our duty is to study the law of instructions. And another question that is asked is, will the good and bad karma cancel each other? I did 7 good karma and I did 3 bad karma. Will it become 4 good karma? No. You have to suffer for 3 bad karma and you have to enjoy 3 good karma. You cannot, you know, negate. That means we are responsible for every action, not a series of actions. And the understanding of the karmic account, you'll understand the whole theory of karma with one example. What is the example? In the olden times, they used to have granaries, huge granaries. And what they would do is that they would put grains on top and remove the grains from below. So when you put, you know, just imagine such a granary exists and you fill the granary half with sawdust and then you put good grains on top and then you open the tap below. What will come out? But I just now I put good grains. Why is sawdust coming out? Because previously I put sawdust. That is the essence of what law of karma is. If you find that good people are having bad things that are happening in their life, wait a minute. Try to see what was put before. So when you put, you know, whatever you put first comes out first. Or it may be instant also. You know, you put good, it may come out the other way also. But the law of karma, for every action, a reaction occurs. That is how we understand it. Now, after understanding all this, the question is, what should I do now? So therefore, we come back to day one. Human life is like a junction. And human life, there are 4 things which are the potentials of human life. A, the ability for higher inquiry. B, the desire to experience bliss. C, making the right choices. And 4, D is determination to follow. That means, now is the time that we need to make the right choices. Now is the time we have to use our ability to make the higher inquiry and make that inquiry and have the determination to follow what is prescribed, and that will lead us to the right direction. That means we need to live responsible lives. Therefore, Krishna, he says, yam yam vyapi smaran bhavam, whatever you remember at the time of death, you know, that is what leads to your next destination. That means we have to be careful how to prepare for that, you know. But then the question is, somebody will ask, that what if I live a life normally without doing anything, and last minute, the moment I'm going to die, I'll sit and remember Krishna's names. Is that fine? It's fine. But can you do it? Because is there any guarantee that we will remain alive for the next 5 minutes also? There's absolutely no guarantee. No doctor, no scientist, no one can give us guarantee about anything about our lives. That means, what is the definition of death or definition of old age? It's proximity to death. So at this point of time, you know, a few days back, something really tragic happened. Some of our friends, this happened in Philadelphia in US, three boys, young, dynamic boys, they were, you know, entering into the highway with a car. And they were just taking a reverse. They had parked, they were just taking a reverse. And while they're taking a reverse, a huge truck, 20-tire truck, hit them, dragged them for 60 yards. All three of them died on the spot. Now, is it ever possible that somebody would miss seeing such a big truck? Impossible. But then it happened. Which means that actually, the way the cycle of karma works is that it's totally unpredictable. What we have done in the past, we don't know. But what we know is that what actions we do now is going to lead to something in the future. Therefore, we have to live responsible lives. And therefore, now, how do you live responsible life? And what is the meaning of living responsible life? I'll tell, conclude with a story which will help us stay inspired until tomorrow. So one time, Srila Prabhupada, you know, the founder of ISKCON, he had gone to, he was in, you know, traveling abroad, and the immigration officer, one lady, she asked him a question. She said, "You are a sadhu, you know, you are living a life of a saint." She said that, "Is it possible people like us can live like you?" He said, "Yes, of course. You don't have to become like me. What you have to do is that constantly remember Krishna." And then he gave a practical example how to do it. Very interesting, you know, how he thought of this example. He said, just like you're working in an office, working in a setup, but even though you're working absorbed in your job, you don't forget for a moment your hairstyle or your makeup. Constantly, you know, thinking whether how I'm looking, right? Similarly, you have to live a life wherever you may be, constantly remembering God. And he gave an example. He said, just like there is a lady who is married to a man, and this lady has another lover. And this lady, when she has another lover, she's staying with her husband, she's constantly thinking of the lover, but she's constantly paying attention to the needs of her husband so that her husband doesn't get doubt. So Prabhupada, he said, similarly, all of us have to act like that lady. Live in this world, function perfectly as if no one knows what we are thinking, but constantly remember our lover, Lord Krishna. That is life. Hare Krishna. So, tomorrow we will conclude the six sessions. Just one announcement before all of you leave. Very important announcement. We have been together for the last 5 days. I'm very grateful to all of you all taking out your valuable time and being here so attentively hearing. But we will end tomorrow. It feels sad that we are going to end. But what to do? We have to continue. But from tomorrow onwards, if you want to stay connected, we are offering you a course. This is called the Advanced Bhagavad Gita course. We will do it once in a week. And we have chosen Tuesday evenings as the day to do this course. So every Tuesday evening, 7 to 9, we'll be having the Advanced Bhagavad Gita course, which will be an in-depth study of what we have studied in the last 6 days.